Hey guys, it's here, Eitan, Benjamin, how are you? Good to see you, Eitan.
How are you, Rebbe?
Baruch Hashem, Baruch Hashem. Got to the finish line, everyone's healthy. Tonight's a Mishmar. And down in Vasikin, and then we'll start worrying about the new boys coming. There's 170 new boys to take in, so a lot happening. So... Baruch Hashem. Okay, so it looks like it's Benjamin can't come tonight, right? Benji can't come, and no, Uriel can't. They both can't come. One's running late.
Yeah, I think Uriel's running late.
Okay, and Benjamin, Benji can't come.
Yeah.
Okay, let's just learn together, and gonna get back to the base medrash. So, I think what happens is a lot of people. So you don't really have that much familiarity with Eicha. You read it at night, the tinus is just beginning, you're focusing on the tinus, and doesn't have as much impact. The kinos, a lot of attention paid to the kinos. Explanations, there are so many great explanations out there. I know the yeshiva asked all of its rabbinic alumni to interpret a different kino. I could send you the list if you want, I'm sure. Rabbi Gottlieb, I mean, there's so many great kinos out there. I've done kinos before. If there is a shiur on Eicha, it's normally afterwards. You got a shiur, you hear Eicha, then there's a shiur afterwards. Wait a second. I missed it. And unlike Michilas Esther, you don't read it again the next day. At least Michilas Esther, you read it once, you're preparing for the next time. So obviously we're not going to learn all of Eicha on our 888 setting, but I just figured pick one pasuk from each parak, five parakim. So at least you'll have one pasuk to think about. And oh, I know that pasuk when you hit that pasuk in Eicha. It's really beautiful, beautiful Megillah. So if you have a Tanakh in front of you, get the Sefer in front of you, I'll read the Pesukim at a pace to have a Tanakh in front of you. You can listen while you're getting a Tanakh. So in Parak Aleph, one of the earlier Pesukim is, remember, it's a Aleph base. Eicha Yashva Badad, Bechol Tifkeh Balayla. That's Pasuk Gimel, which begins with a Gimel. Golsa Yehuda Mi'oni Merov Avoda. That Am Yisrael, in this case, Yehuda, remember, Yehuda meant the southern Shvatim, because the northern Shvatim were already exiled. So now Yirmiyah is mourning the exile of the southern Shevet and Binyamin, Yehuda, Binyamin. So Yehuda is a nickname for both. I think Binyamin left, here's Binyamin back. So Golsa Yehuda, Meoni, Umerov Avodah. So the words Meoni and Rov Avodah could mean two different things. It could mean that their exile was occasioned by a lot of poverty, a lot of hard work, and a lot of slavery. So it would be read Golsa Yehuda Birov Oni Uverov Avodah. But Targum Onkelos interprets it that this is the cause for the Gols. That because they ignored the plight of the weak, of the Oni, and because they abused their Avadim, because even though you have, remember, a very interesting question about how the Tanakh looks on Avdos, and obviously in those days you needed manpower as part of their society. Today it's obviously wildly unjust. But there has to be some moderation. You have to free a slave if he's a Jew after 6 years. And there was an abuse of the privilege of being a slave owner. And they worked in slaves too hard. And because society wasn't based on equality and protecting the weak and charity and righteousness, it collapsed. So when you think about a society unable to sustain itself, the Gemara of Metziah says that Yerushalayim was destroyed in the first place on Mikdash because they kept the din. And the Gemara asks in the Gemara Bavim Tzia Daf Lamed, wait a second, if you keep halacha, you shouldn't collapse, you should sustain, you should endure. Whereas says, no, they weren't able to extend Lefnim Mishur HaSedin. They became very legalistic and very exacting. What do you deserve and what are my rights? And they weren't able to act outside of the box and through generosity and through virtue and self-sacrifice. So Golsa Yehuda Me'oni U'Me'rov Avodah. They neglected the poor. They worked their slaves or others too hard. Second part of the pasuk, three parts of this pasuk, he ashva bagoyim, she has now been exiled. Yehuda, a female, has been exiled. Am Yisrael is compared very often to a female because we're married to Hashem. And because we're married to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, I'll get to that pasuk maybe later, right? That's a, there are many different versions. That's the version of the Gemara Ben Nesia. So she's a woman who betrayed her husband. She's an Isha Zona, as Yirmiyahu refers to in Israel. So he Ashra Bagoyim Lo Matzah Manoach, and she was unable to find peace and unable to find tranquility and unable, and there's constant movement from one country to another country to another continent. Now, this pasuk, Eicha, Lo Matzah Manoach, Yirmiyahu is actually borrowing from Devarim. Where is it in Devarim? I'll pick it up quickly here. Where is it in Devarim? Right, so there's twice in the Torah that this pasuk appears. The one that you're more familiar with is in Devarim and Kisavo and the Tochacha, Uvagoyim Ahim Lo Targia, Velohia Manoach Lekaf Raglecha. See if I can even share the screen for you. That when you travel to these nations, you won't have any rest and you will be constantly on the run. You can see my screen here. Velohia Manoach Lekaf Raglecha. See that pasuk in Kitavo. But all of these, both the pasuk in Eicha, Lo Matzah Manoach, and the pasuk in Kisavo, are built off of the pasuk in Noach, because Noach, the Yonah, didn't find Manoach. The Lo Matzah HaYonah Manoach LeKaf Ragla. So, V'Yelo Matzah HaYonah Manoach LeKaf Ragla, V'Lo Tia Manoach LeKaf Raglecha in Kisavo. So Yirmiyah draws those words and says, Lo Matzah Manoach, that Am Yisrael won't find peace and tranquility. Now, what's interesting about this phrase is Chazal Darshan, very often in the Medrash, that this is a hidden bracha. Because if the Jews were to get too comfortable in Gullus, they'd never come back. So Hashem is winking at us. On the one hand, you'll suffer the constant portability and constant movement. On the other hand, it will assure that you return. I just interviewed Rabbi Berman from YU, and we were discussing some, reminiscing about our days in Yeshiva and our days in YU. And I remember when I was living in YU, my wife and I were very conscious not to establish our roots in America, because we knew that once we place roots and we take jobs and we didn't move into a community. We lived in Washington Heights, which then there may have been 10 firm couples, maybe 10 firm couples in the Heights, maybe. And we decided we wanted to be transient because we wanted to move to Eretz Yisrael. We knew that the more comfortable we got in Chutz Laaretz, the more difficult it would be. There's a very scary Masorah. The Masorah goes as follows. One of the sad points of Tisha B'Av, aside from the Churban Beis HaMikdash, are opportunities that were lost. One of the great lost opportunities was when Ezra returned in the days of the construction of the second Beis HaMikdash, he invites all the Jews to join him. Sadly, only 42,000 or so Jews joined. Most remain in Shushan. That's part of the Purim drama. And for according to the Gemara Megillah, this is why the second Beis HaMikdash never got traction. Namely, the way the Gemara Megillah presents it, had all of Am Yisrael returned during the second Beis HaMikdash, it would have been Mashiach, and we would have averted 2,000 years of Gullus. There's a Masara that says that the Jews of Germany, there were Jews evidently, which is astounding, were exiled to Germany in the first Beis HaMikdash. We think they were all exiled to Babylonia, to Iraq, to Iran. Evidently, the Jews went to Germany, and Ezra writes them a letter, and they write back to Ezra. They say, well, you go to Yerushalayim, we'll stay in Germany, which is Yerushalayim HaKtana, mini Jerusalem, because they've been so warm to us and they've greeted us so hospitably. Because of writing that Germany's Yerushalayim HaKtana, German Jews, the Masara goes, were forever fated to suffer disproportionately to other Jews. Because of that letter, because it's one thing not to return for all sorts of complications and barriers, it's another thing to refer to Germany or any other city as mini Yerushalayim. That's a violation that's just too hurtful and just too audacious to not be accounted for. So it's an interesting pasuk. In Eicha, again, Golsa Yehuda Me'oni Merov Avodah, the collapse of morality, integrity, and righteousness. Lo Matzah Manoach Kol Rofei Sigua Bein HaMitzarim. It's a famous pasuk. And all of our enemies chased us down between the walls. We had no place to hide. We were fenced in, which is a very popular phraseology in Eicha. But the word Bein HaMitzarim became the phrase for between Shiva Asar and Tisha B'Av, the 3 weeks Bein HaMitzarim. But of course, in Eicha, in Perek Aleph, Pasuk Gimel, it means between boundaries. We were caught. We had no place to hide. And so now let's flip forward to the second parak. In the second parak of Eicha, very interesting pasuk. Let's see if we find it. Okay, let's start with pasuk Tes, remember? Second parak is also Aleph Beis. That's easy. Pasuk Tes is going to be a pasuk that begins with Tes. And it talks about the gates and the walls that sunk. Okay, it's a very powerful visual. We know that Shiva Asar is the day that the gates were breached. And the gates and the walls in those days afforded a sense of security. Throughout the Torah, Moshe is inquiring of the Meraglim, do they live in walled cities? Do they live in open cities? Walled cities are more fortified. So when the walls of Yerushalayim are breached, obviously it's not too soon. The fate of the Beis HaMikdash is more or less been sealed. So the Pasuk describes, Tavu va'aretz shereha, the she'arim, the gates, are drowning, they're sinking. Ibad v'shibar b'richa, b'richa is a lock, so the locks are also being lost, and they're being flung open and pulverized, so the locks don't matter anymore. So the first part of the Pasuk talks about the gates. And what's interesting about the gates is, this is also related to a Medrash. The Medrash says that Nebuchadnezzar, see, Nebuchadnezzar is interesting. Nebuchadnezzar as an enemy represents a break with the old-fashioned enemy. The old-fashioned enemy is a heathen who denies God, who maybe is hedonistic, pleasure-seeking, scoundrel, paganistic, those people, the Bilams, the Paros, the irreligious, dumb, unintelligent, unenlightened thinkers. Nebuchadnezzar is royalty. Nebuchadnezzar is a scribe in the Assyrian army. Nebuchadnezzar has dreams. Nebuchadnezzar is a spiritual person. He thinks about history. And he knows that the Jews can't really be surmounted because they're Hashem's chosen people. And he sends his henchman, Nebuzaradan, who spends many years encircling Yerushalayim, and he just can't breach the wall. So we know what happens once the walls are breached, but evidently it was a three-year siege that caused a lot of the hunger that we read about in the Kinos, where babies were being eaten by parents. A lot of hunger in the first Beis HaMikdash siege. But what convinces Nebuchadnezzar that he can ultimately topple the Jewish people is he visits the walls. He actually comes to visit his general, Nebuzaradan, and he sees the walls sinking a few tefachim each day. And the fact that the walls are sinking a few tefachim into the ground each day supernaturally gives him confidence that this is divinely decreed and that he can, at this point, conquer and displace the Jewish people. Now, what's interesting is that it's not just the Nebuchadnezzar that saw the gates sinking, but the Jews saw the gates sinking also. So you can imagine you're living in the first base of Mikdash and all that's necessary is to perform tshuva, because Hashem will rescue you last minute. To the last minute, they refuse tshuva. And you even see gates sinking, but evidently deniability and the narratives that we script for ourselves to deny reality and to live certain fictions are so powerful, they can even counter empirical realities or empirical messages. It's really important in life that sometimes we pay attention to the signs, especially when they deviate from our expectations, when they deviate from our narratives. It's called contraindication. We fill with certain indications, and then there's other facts that counterindicate, and stubborn people refuse to listen, and they just rewrite the facts based according to their own script. So here, if they just would have listened, this whole tragedy could have been avoided. So there's an inner rebuke of not listening to the obvious. And then the end of the pasuk is also interesting. Malkev v'sarev v'goyim ein Torah. So our leaders were dispatched amongst the Gentile nations where there's no Torah. And Chazal see this as a reference to the fact, well, you will be traveling to foreign cultures where there will be wisdom and science and culture, Chachma b'goyim tamin, but you won't have Torah. And keep in mind that the first Beis HaMikdash is a little bit different from the second Beis HaMikdash. In the second Beis HaMikdash, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai essentially prepares Torah to be poured into Chutz La'aretz. He swaps Yerushalayim for Yavne, and ultimately for the Sanhedrin, and already, keep in mind, already Bavel is a Torah center. So if you're leaving Yerushalayim in the second Beis HaMikdash, you're just going to Lakewood. I mean, you're going to Yeshiva in Chutz La'aretz. You know there are people waiting for you. You know there's Torah being studied there. You know there are Jews. You know there's Shechita. In the case of the first Beis HaMikdash, you're walking into nowhere's land. There was a shift. Remember, there are 18-year shifts. The first 18 years, a lot of the leadership, Daniel, a lot of the young leaders had been exiled 18 years before the destruction, but it really is walking into the unknown. And the question is, can you rebuild Torah in that interim? And it's not entirely clear what was or wasn't rebuilt. Obviously, it was a 70-year period, so not much could have been lost, but we don't see great Torah production. Again, it's in between two Batei Mikdash. So Malkev v'sarev v'goyim ein Torah, you have a sense that Torah may not make it, may not survive when you leave Yerushalayim, because your association with Torah is based on Mikdash. Our association with Torah is but the Medrash all over the world. Their association with Torah was Yerushalayim. That basically makes maybe you'll lose Torah. So this is an interesting phrase. Remember, it's Yirmiyah, so it's not second base on Mikdash, but everything Yirmiyah says has connotations for the second base on Mikdash. Also, Gam Nivieha lo matzil chazon mehashem. Her prophets will no longer receive their visions from Hashem. Now, this is a double entendre in this pasuk. It means on the one hand that Am Yisrael's prophets will leave into Chutz Laretz where they can no longer experience Nevuah, which is especially true for Yirmiyah. The second base of Mikdash, they had already been bereft of Nevuah for 400 years. So they didn't lose Nevuah with the second exile. But now you're entering into Galus and there is a break in Nevuah. There will be no Nevuah. The only Nevuah is Yechezkel, who already been dispatched to certain rivers in Babel, but he was during the days of the base of Mikdash, not after the Churban. So you've got a 70-year hiatus of Nevuah. And the only Sefer that's written that's canonized is Megillas Esther, and Hashem's name doesn't appear. So not only is there no prophecy, but the shame of Hashem has become invisible. But there's a undercurrent to this phrase that's very relevant to the second Beis HaMikdash. And the Nevi'eha that this pasuk refers to are not just the Jewish prophets, but Nevi'eha means the Goyim. If you look at the direct grammatical antecedent, it's Malkah v'sareba Goyim ein Torah. There's no Torah in the Gentile nations. Nevi'eha lo matzu chazon, and those prophets of the Gentile nations will not receive divine vision. Well, which prophets are these sukkim referring to? They will not receive divine vision. In the second Beis HaMikdash, it is a foreshadowing that other religions will offer prophets, the Jesuses and the Muhammads, and they will claim that they have vision from God. And Yirmiyah is debunking that once the Beis HaMikdash is destroyed, Hashem's prophecy and supernaturalism ends. So it's fundamentally impossible for there to be Nevuah b'zman hazeh because the source of Nevuah has been shut. It's fundamentally impossible. So whatever claims Christians will make about Jesus, whatever claims Muslims will make about Muhammad, are debunked. Gam nevi'eha lo matzu chazon le'eis Hashem. So I think Yirmiyah is referring to a little bit of each. We're exiting Yerushalayim, and there'll be a struggle to rebuild Torah, but there won't be prophecy both to Jewish Nevi'im as well as the other names. So that's the pasuk in Perek Beis. The gates are sinking. There's no Torah, and there's no Nevuah. Let's fast forward to Perek Gimel. Perek Gimel, let's turn to pasuk Chav Ches. Perek Gimel is not Aleph Beis one at a time. It's three psukim for each letter. The psukim are much shorter. They're much briefer. And they're meant to be read in a panting. There's a minute to read them panting. So you're so frustrated with the loss of Yerushalayim, that you just read in Tov Hashem Lekavod, Nefesh Hidrushenu, Tov Yachil. There's no trap. There's no structure to the sentence. It's five or six words per sentence. You're not going to make a whole song out of it. So if you look at Pasuk Chav Ches and Chav Tes, it's an important, important message. I recorded something yesterday. You can listen to it a little bit more extensively. But Tisha B'Av is not a day for tshuva, primarily. Don't turn Tisha B'Av into Yom Kippur. Tisha B'Av is a day to think about the tragedy of Jewish history, the struggle, the commitment, the frustration, the persecution, the loss, how close we were to utopia, how frustrated we are. Hashem is rebuilding Yerushalayim. We're so close, but yet so far. It's not a day to be clinical and formulaic. How can I improve? Let me give you an example. Imagine Chas V'Shalom the scene. You find yourself sitting over a grave in a terrible tragedy. Someone young, Chas V'Shalom dies. And that person, Chas V'Shalom, is close to you, and you're standing over the grave. And everyone around you is shrieking and crying and screaming. And you're sitting there and saying, well, these are the lessons I think we should take away from this tragedy. We should improve this, and we should improve this, and I should have done more of this. That would be monstrous. People are standing at the grave, crying, suffering. You just cry and wail and moan and shriek. And a couple of days later, you say, well, what can I learn from this? Tisha B'Av primarily, at least the first part, is a day of Avelos. That's why I personally am opposed to public gatherings. I don't like to speak. Sometimes I am the guest, I have to speak. There were a lot of organizations that asked me to record stuff this year for Tisha B'Av. I said, one condition, I'll pre-record them all. You can screen it whatever you want, as long as you make it clear that this is not happening on Tisha B'Av. I like to sit quietly, ponder, cry, absorb. If I speak in public, I don't look at people. I don't like to present myself. I just go into that quiet place in myself, and I think of this pasuk. This is my Tisha B'Av pasuk. Look at Perek Gimel pasuk Chav Ches. Yeshev Badad V'Yidom. You sit alone and you're quiet. Ki Natal Alav. Because your glory has been taken from you. Yeshev Badad V'Yidom. Because your glory has been stripped. And then the continuation of the pasuk, yitain be'afar pihu, you put dirt in your mouth. Ula yesh tikva, and maybe there'll be some hope. Chazal said that when Rabbeinu HaKadosh, reached this pasuk, when he read Echa, he started wailing. And what made him wail is the end of pasuk Chavtes, ulai yesh tikva. What do you mean, ulai yesh tikva? Of course there's tikva. But if you get so frustrated, at a certain point, you're unsure, and there's some kinos to read. I don't have time to take you through the kinos, that we just become so angry at the frustration of Jewish history and how sad it is. So these are two psukim. I don't have to give much interpretation to them, but just when they hit you, know what they mean. I know it's hard. You're in families. My perfect Tisha B'Av, and it's hard sometimes, and I'm not going to do it this year because I have, you know, my family, like everyone else, under a lot of stress, and people around that have a new baby in the house. But the perfect Tisha B'Av, don't try this if you can hurt people's feelings. Perfect Tisha B'Av is total silence. You don't talk. You don't say hello. When people call the house, I instruct the kids not to say hello. There's a Tarragon resident. Just, you know, pick it up and let the person talk. You're an Avil. You're quiet. Yeshiv Badad V'yidom. And even when I've been in different places, last year I was in Australia. 2 years ago I was in Manchester, England. I told my host, I'm not going to talk over Tisha B'Av. Don't be insulted. I don't mean to. I'm not friendly. I'm not mean or rude. It's not a day for me to be conversing with other human beings. I want to feel. And don't do it just for effect. If you're not at that emotional stage, don't act out of your league religiously. That's terrible. And try to act as someone you're not. Try to be authentic. Try to act exactly who you are. But that's your goal one day. And certainly don't redirect Tisha B'Av away from that goal. And sometimes tshuva is redirecting away from that goal. It's really meant to be avelus, not tshuva. There's a whole shiur about that. They're not deminus l'halacha. You're not avelus in tshuva. You don't read yud gimel midos. You don't say slichos. A lot of nafgaminos for the fact it's not a day of tshuva. Okay. Let's fast forward to Megillah's Echa Perek Dalet. Perek Dalet talks about Yoshiyahu. Yoshiyahu was the last great white hope. Yoshiyahu was the king, and at a very, very young age, he had a change of heart, and he realized all the terrible, terrible habits that the Melachim of Malchus Beis David had acquired and had entrenched, and he leads this major, major religious revolution. And this is really the last chance for Am Yisrael to recover and to avoid the chait of, or to avoid the Churban Beis HaMikdash. If you're interested in reading a little bit about this, you can look in the end of Melachim Beis. Where's it? Melachim Beis. I'd say probably Perach of Beis Chav Gimel. You're starting to see this young king, Yoshiyahu. He's listening to Kriyas HaTorah. They find. What happens is they try to refurbish the Beis HaMikdash. When they refurbish the Beis HaMikdash, they find the Sefer Torah. It's hard to sound like they didn't even know what a Sefer Torah was in the first Beis HaMikdash. Oh, what is this? Oh, it's a Sefer Torah. It can't be. That's too crazy. They find a special Sefer Torah of Moshe Rabbeinu, and a pasuk hits him. Aro Asher Lo Yakim is Divrei HaTorah Azaz in Parshat Kitavo. He says, I must be the person to rebuild Torah. And it leads a major revolution where he expels all the Avodah Zarah. And you have this rising surge of religion and reformation and religious rehabilitation. And everything is meant to reverse all the terrible, terrible failures of previous generations. So much so that in Perek Dalid, okay, so now when we go to Echa, Perek Dalid, he is referred to in Pasuk Chaf as Mashiach. Ruach Apeinu Mashiach Hashem. This is the hesped that Yirmiyah writes when Yoshiyahu is killed. And we'll see in a moment why he's killed. So he calls him Mashiach Hashem. Now again, the word Mashiach doesn't mean what it means for us, but it certainly has connotations that are redemptive, that are apocalyptic. So he refers to him as Mashiach Hashem. I find this pasuk very corona ironic. Ruach Apeinu, the oxygen of our nose. Ruach Apeinu, Mashiach Hashem. Why would the Mashiach be called Ruach Apeinu? It's like so visceral, so much a part of us. Ruach HaPeinu, Mashiach Hashem, what happened? Nilkad b'shechisosam, was caught in their traps. Shiach, baras shichin ma'aros, shiach is like a little trap or an indentation or a pit that you dig in the ground. Baras shichin ma'aros, what were these pits? So what happens was that there were, Yoshiyahu was killed in a very strange fashion. Because remember there's this surge and he's a tzaddik and Hashem is willing to grant kapara. What happened was there's a war that breaks out between Nebuchadnezzar, Melech Bavel in the north, and Mitzrayim in the south. And Mitzrayim is looking to travel through Eretz Yisrael on their way to Bavel to fight this war. And they ask Yoshio for permission. And Yoshio doesn't grant permission, and he goes to defend Israel against Mitzrayim. He defends basically Nebuchadnezzar against Mitzrayim. He goes to war with Mitzrayim because he doesn't want Mitzrayim to travel through Israel on the way to Nebuchadnezzar. And the irony is he's defending Nebuchadnezzar, who years later will destroy the Beis HaMikdash. So they're shifting alliances. He's preventing Mitzrayim from traveling through Israel. He gets killed by the Egyptians in war in Megiddo, and he ultimately defends indirectly his ultimate conqueror. Now, why this is so sad and why there's such a big deal made about it in Eicha, and why Yirmiyah writes such a famous hesped and why it's incorporated into Eicha, is it's reflective of something larger. What happens is as follows. You see, over the last 2,000 years, religion has become very, very contracted. What does it mean to be a religious Jew? It means Torah and davening and community and staka and chesed and midos. But it used to be, and now it is once again, nationhood and sovereignty. When you get to Israel, you'll see there's so many aspects of religion in addition to our learning and our mitzvos. How do we build a society that's just? How do we build a political system that's just? How do we build social welfare that's just? Police, army, states, diplomacy, international, how we influence other nations. And this was more reflective of the first Beis HaMikdash, when the Jews really were very international. And there are people that are visiting the Beis HaMikdash. Hiram donates to the Beis HaMikdash. He wants to be part of the Beis HaMikdash. Malchus Shiva from Ethiopia, from Africa, visits the Beis HaMikdash. He wants to learn about Shlomo. He's being praises on Shlomo. So the Jews are very involved in the entire world and in politics by definition. But, and here's the problem, they become a little bit too involved in politics. They became too reliant on foreign beings. And a lot of the tochach of the Nevi'im is they're relying on Mitzrayim, they're relying on Asher, they're relying on. And the irony or the highlight of that hyper-involvement is, why are you fighting a war between Mitzrayim and Bavel? What, like, why is that your war? Let Mitzrayim and Bavel duke it out and you just stay on the sidelines, take a pass on this one. And the tragedy that the last great white hope was sacrificed on the battlefield, a futile battlefield, it's pointless. Why are you fighting Egypt? They have no beef with you. They're not interested in invading the land of Israel. So that's what this whole war represents, that even righteous Jews, even penitent Jews, even religious-minded Jews are just too engrossed in the dynamics of ancient Mesopotamian politics. And it's an important part for living in Israel today. We have to be involved in global politics. We have to be involved in geopolitics. But we can't be over-reliant on it, and we can't forget the supernatural forces that call us and that dictate reality. And it's that nice pull me, push me that's so fundamental to life in Israel, where you can't take a back seat, you can't take a seat on the sideline, but you can't believe that it all depends on what this one will say, or the quartet will say, or the UN will say, or Hamas will say, or even our own politicians. We've been involved in politics, but the real drama is in Shemayim, and the real drama is how much Torah you learn, how much mitzvahs you perform, and how much Avodas Hashem you'll perform in the quiet of your heart. Okay, one final pasuk, the pasuk in Perek Hey. There's a lot of famous pasukim, obviously, Avshaveinu Hashem Melecha Venashuva, the end. But the pasuk that I wanted to tell you is the pasuk Zayin, Avoseinu Chatam Chatu Ve'enam, Ve'anachnu Avonasehem Savalnu. It's a very important concept in Chassidus, Dafka. And in Chassidus, we have the ability to be Mechaper on the Avonas of previous generations. And it may sound very, of course, it's a nice vart, but it's very, very different from what we normally think about. We normally think about generations as diminishing in their worth and in their capacity. It's called Niskat Nuhadaros. Niskat Nuhadaros does not mean that every single part of subsequent generations is diminished compared to previous generations. It means that since earlier generations were closer to Har Sinai, they're closer to the source, they're more authoritative, they're closer to supernaturalism, we have to defer to them halachically. But there are possibilities for this is really baked into the heart of Chassidus. There are possibilities and potentials for later generations to atone. I think that a lot of the dedication that we're showing in Israel today is atoning for the Chet of the Dor HaMidbar, that we are showing sacrifice and courage to build this country against all the opposition, against all the Anakim, against all the giants, and we're atoning for their sins. And that's what this pasuk means. Avoseinu chatu ve'inam, ve'anachnu avonoseim savalnu. We're carrying their sins, and we have the choice to stop carrying them, but we're not just these midgets that get tossed, these weights that we just carry through, but we have the ability to rectify them and to alter them. So these are the pasuk from each parak in Eicha so there's at least some reference point. If you have a little bit of time, again, either spend some time or Kina spend some time on Echa, but a lot of these words are still foreign to you. You're not that conversant in Hebrew. A lot of the ideas are foreign. I have a series on Kina that's about 7 or 8 years old. You can get it on Why You Tar, just do Moshe Tarek and Kina. You can look through them, but I'm sure there's, I'll send you a, you know, if I can get my hands on the Gush list, and just try to spend a little bit of time just to give yourself a fighting chance to get into a little bit of Tisha B'Av spirit. Okay? Have an easy fast, and we'll try for next week also, okay?
Rebbe, is it okay if I ask a question quickly?
Sure, go ahead.
In regards to what Rebbe suggested in Parak Dalet regarding Yoshiyahu, so, I mean, the Gemara in Tanis seems to understand it differently in regards to V'chayr V'losav or V'yar Zechem. So, how would you,
Look, there are different angles to his opposition. And the Gemara does say that he wanted to protect the safety of Israel and fulfill that pasuk. But it's clear that Yirmiyah, by saying Nilkad B'shchisosam, and I didn't fully explicate this, he's talking about a double entendre. He got caught in their pits because ancient warfare, you dug pits and moats and people fell in and were captured, like Rashi says about the four and the five kings in Parshas Lech Lecha. So literally means he got caught in their pits. But Nilkad B'shchisosam means he got caught in their snare and in all those politics. And certainly if you read Vayikonen Yirmiyah, it's one of the kinos, I think it's like the fourth or fifth kina in the day. Vayikonen Yirmiyah Yoshiyahu. If you read through that kina, I think the Rav probably has some writings on it in his kina's book, you'll see that the kina is a little bit rebuking of Yoshiyahu for getting involved in this. So it's certainly as lofty as some of his motives were to prevent the sword from trampling through the country, it just seems like he should have taken a pass on this. And it's not a chayt, it's reflective of an orientation that was off during the first base. And making sure that even Yoshiyahu, such a tzaddik, even such a reformer, just couldn't escape the political intrigue and entrenchment of the first base of Mikdash. Okay? Second base of Mikdash is different. Second base of Mikdash, to their credit, they resist political entanglement. They resist the Greeks. They resist. So they have their own flaws. The first base of Mikdash has become a little too comfortable in their internationalism. Okay?
Thank you.
You're welcome. Laila Tov, guys. Wish me luck for staying up. I don't know how I'm going to make it, but I'll try.
Is there a recording of Rai Berman from today?
Yeah, it'll be put up tomorrow. So.
Okay, perfect. Okay, thank you, Abby.
If you don't get it, it's all on the Gush Facebook, but if you don't get it, it's in the WhatsApp.
It's not on YouTube. It's on Facebook.
No, it's on YouTube. It will be on YouTube.
Oh, okay.
But they post it on the Gush Facebook.
Okay, perfect. Okay, thank you. Have an easy fast.
Thank you. You too, Benjamin.